Here.
Councilmember Stout?
Here.
Councilmember Wisnowski?
He is excused, he will be here late. He will be here, oh, that's not him. So, our work session today, we're gonna have Mr. Botcher go over the transportation improvement program and the, review the addendum to the capital, 2019 to 2024 capital improvement plan, Mr. Botcher.
Thank you, Mayor. Little bit on the process, this is an annual update of the transportation improvement plan. We've held one workshop and then a hearing, reviewed things at the public work, projects at the Public Works Committee. We've made some adjustments. In the public hearing, we received a comment that they would like to see more information. So let's look at the information that we do provide. We provide kind of the expected year or, and so there, and the ranking of the projects, the terminus of the projects, which also kind of gives you the length, though we don't put in how long the project might be. We describe the type of improvements and then the length in miles is in the third column, and then estimated cost and where we expect the funding to come from. So I guess with that, is there some additional information that you would like to see in this?
So I had gone over and looked at it as well when the comments made, but I don't know what more really you could put in there. You know, I mean, chip sealing and grinding, a two-lane roundabout is pretty
We put in, if we know the details, the type of work we're going to be doing, we'll put that in.
Yeah.
Keep in mind though, once we get a project on a budget, then it's gonna come before the council, perhaps in more detail through the budget process. Then there'll be, as we bring forward a design contract, then you'll have much more detail to review on the various aspects. We're just reviewing the scope of work from the consultant. And then we go through the environmental review process. And that's where the process really opens up to the public, is once we go through the environmental review.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, it's a plan. It's a wish list. And so we need, you know, we don't have to have all of that finite detail because we don't know. And even with the rankings, if there is a grant that becomes available that's farther on down on our list, but we have access to that grant, it moves up because it's money for our city. So I understand what Kristen wanted to do, but this isn't the vehicle for that kind of information. This is just like, I want to go to Nordstrom's and I want to buy a new outfit for something. Seriously, it's the same idea, except that we actually know how much we think it's going to cost.
Right.
And so that's, keep that
in mind.
I would
go to the clearance rack.
Well, okay, I don't shop at Nordstrom's anymore anyway, and their stock went down when I
The other point that we discussed was that if a project isn't on this TIP, then we are not eligible for grants.
Right.
Unless we, like, throw it on there really quickly. So these are not fleshed out projects that are in the works right now. And does the city staff have more information about each one of these line items? Well, yes, but it really doesn't come to fruition until it comes to the top of the list and we're ready to go forward with that project. So Once again, the purpose of this TIP is for planning purposes and looking to the future. These are not under construction projects, right?
Right.
Yeah.
There is more, there is more information in behind the scenes. I mean, we have done the ranking of our condition of asphalt on all the streets within the city. And we use that to help prioritize streets. But it's not the only thing, because we also look at if the condition of the asphalt, what's the classification of the street. So there's other on if a street has high levels of traffic and has a deteriorating level of the pavement is deteriorating, we're going to take that at a higher priority if it's in on an arterial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
Melissa's got a question or a comment.
Yes.
Well, I'm making a comment because I reading articles through the paper and stuff, and I'm looking through our TIP here and seeing that I do see multiple developer funded projects, and I see where that's being funded. And then the ones that are not being funded or half funded by developer, those are just general city maintenance stuff that we would do regardless if we didn't have a developer or whatever, 10
that's
trials
correct.
Around. So when we talk about developer paying for growth, I mean, to me, I see here that they're paying quite a bit of stuff in their growth. In our growth, you know, with our roundabouts, in our Morgan Creek, you know, connections and stuff like that. So,
totally, yeah.
I mean, I just want to point that out, that, you know, growth is paying for growth, and the ones that they're not paying for is really and truly just maintenance, like you said, weeding your yard,
or
your roads.
Deficiencies that currently existed before 10 trails.
Exactly,
exactly.
And as the city grows, we all grow regardless if we had growth, no matter what. We still have to maintain whatever's there, and we do add sidewalks to improve our cities and stuff like that. So I think the 10 trails or whatever is paying for growth.
Well, not only that, they're also paying the entire MDRT staffing.
Right.
So anything that's associated with 10 trails is 100% funded by
right.
the developer.
Right.
Okay. So just to be clear on the 10 Oak Point's paying staffing. Oak Point pays the city. The city then pays staff for all that.
No, it's the other way around. They reimburse us
after
we pay
it. So, okay, so yeah, so the city still pays it, then Oak Point pays the city. It doesn't go from Oak Point to the
correct.
The staff
yeah.
member.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so my other question, and maybe this is a good time to talk about it. So in the development agreement, it talks about that the city goes out in good faith for grants on projects that we are deficient in, like Edelman
yes.
said. So in here where it says developer funded and frontage improvements and developer mitigation and possible grant funding, are these the areas where we are deficient, but we're going out in good faith to get that grant?
Yes.
And if we don't get that grant, then does the developer pay that full price, or do we continue to push it and wait until we do get a grant? So just maybe a little clarification on all that.
When there are projects that, let's take the Ravensdale Roberts Drive roundabout.
Big one.
It's a big project, and being a small city, we can't get very much money
mm-hmm.
for that type of project. However, we have applied for the grant on the stormwater side, and that's where we purchased that property. It helped seems paltry compared to what they're spending, but it still helped. And we did our due diligence that was an arena where we could get some money. If we cannot find a grant or we don't come through with the grant, they are still obligated on other timeframes by the development agreement and have to move forward whether we get the grant or not.
And that's where we, in good faith, we're showing that we're trying and we're going out. We're not just trying to skip our duties of things that are in the city that have already been deficient for a long time. And now we have that help with the developer, and hopefully that we get grants to help along with that.
Now, another thing too, like on number 9 here, the Morgan Creek pedestrian connection, says developer funded. That's not Oak Point.
It's not.
That's gonna be whoever develops that property, that frontage property on 169. They're the ones that are then gonna be obligated to put in that, the frontage improvements, yeah.
And if I could.
Go ahead, Tammy.
Well, I was just gonna say, just like what the electrical company had to do.
And even no different than the housing development that's up here. There were a lot of improvements that they had to do as a small development. Cause I think they put in sidewalks and repaved and made the road.
Do you mean Lawson Hills Estates?
No, it's up off of, yeah.
Olympic Avenue. Olympic.
Well, or it's off of Fifth.
They're like 10 houses up there.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask one more question for more clarification. I believe that whatever deficiencies existed in the city before any development began is still the responsibility of the city, that it's not the responsibility of the developer to fix what was already broken. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Not entirely. In the situation of our water system, we were significantly deficient in redundancy, if we have a backup water supply. We were also significantly deficient in fire flow and fire emergency standby storage to fight fire. Those, according to the water supply facilities funding agreement, they bought the water from Tacoma. They committed to not only meet their needs, but upfront pay for the storage and the intertie with Tacoma and the rehabilitation of our springs. So those were deficiencies already existed, but through that agreement are to be covered by the developer. Now they get reimbursed through system development charge credit or waiving those fees, but it's we don't have to come up with the upfront cash. So.
And the other deficiency that we had in fire flow was resolved in Old Town when they put in the water line to go to 10 Trails.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, true.
So that was a net benefit for Morganville, yeah.
And those residents there have been already living there before development even came.
Yeah.
Another question. The resident that spoke regarding the transportation and bus lines and metro, how does that play into, does that fall into this?
No.
Something different?
Yeah.
Okay.
Metro isn't part of the transportation improvement plan.
You might if I drive up here. So, I mean, one thing that's really important is to realize how public works and community development, how the land use and the public infrastructure improvements are all really have to be, we work hand in hand, hand in glove, if you want to say that. So you started out with these policies that were, you know, these are the things that it's our policy to do in terms of providing public service or providing access or whatever the case may be as you went through your comp plan. Then that gets enacted through your land use codes, but also through these budget documents. So this transportation improvement plan is really this little kind of mini budget document for now we're gonna list these projects that we just said were important to do, and we're gonna try to work towards funding and getting them done. With the metro thing, that's not a city's transportation project, but we have policy about in the transportation chapter of the comp plan about how we wanna make sure that, that we have public transportation options, and so those were where we, where you saw policies about how we're gonna work together with Metro, and so all of this stuff really works together. You don't have these discrete things that are all supposed to be working together.
Yeah, thank you for that.
The planners, also as part of the, in going through the approval process with the master plan developer, there is, at some juncture, there's a requirement for a park and ride. So, but the bus, when more people are here, then you're more likely to be able to lobby the Metro to get more bus service.
Well, and from being on skateboard, last year they added a morning service and an evening service that they had recently taken away. And they also have, I've talked to them about using those two parking lots on Highway 169 for a park and ride. So they are aware of our position because I've been going to that board for like 7 years, so they are pretty, know what we require, and will continue to look at the ridership from Enum Claw since they're growing too, and see if they need to add that service back to Enum Claw or not, so.
Okay, so you wanna go, go to the capital improvement plan addendum?
So, well, wait, are we done with the six-year conversation?
I thought we were.
But I just.
You have one more comment?
No, I would just, you know, just make sure everybody's good with what's on there before we move it to vote, and that we're, didn't have anything we wanted to add or any more questions on it, but I'm good.
That would be up to you too, because it's already been through the Public Works Committee, and we've, we voted to bring it forward to the council.
So I'm just saying before Seth moved on, just make sure that everybody is good and didn't have any more questions or wanted to add or anything.
You good?
I think I'm okay.
Yeah, okay.
I like it.
And I think too, just off the top of my head, if, you know, Councilmember Wisnowski comes in now that we're done with this and says, oh, by the way, what about, Seth can change it, he can bring it up in front of the council next week, and you can have your discussion then.
Well, even at council, we can change it or ask.
You can change it, sure.
We can push it anywhere.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to be sure that everybody know that Seth was moving on from that and that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not the chair.
There also are, this is a flexible document. We work together to rearrange the order of the project already this year and brought some from quite a bit lower ranking up to a higher level. I think three projects were moved around. So it's not that this plan is set in concrete as far as the order or, you know, it depends on funding, it depends on need, and whatever makes sense to work on in the city. So just because we move this forward doesn't mean it can't ever change.
Nice, that's right.
Okay, so let us move on to the addendum to the capital improvement plan.
Okay, we're, thank you for considering to add these three projects. We are anxious to take good steps to amend how we treat traffic mitigation for infill development in the city. Our current system is administratively burdensome.
You can't hear.
And it's not totally equitable. We can only collect from traffic trips that go through failed intersections. So if you have a, an intersection that is about to fail, even, and you know you're gonna need to make improvements to it within the next 6 years, you can't collect any funds on it until it fails. So a traffic impact, these planning study will help you kind of smooth out those types of things. The other problem is you have a big expensive project. fixed, once it's fixed, you can no longer collect on it. So there's these just short windows that you can collect funding for a failed intersection. And that's not equitable, it's not fair, it's not, everyone's not sharing the burden of the expense of those capacity adding projects. So anyway, we'd like to get started with that. And then also, thank you for your support on the power generation facility. I think it's environmentally responsible thing for us to do. And if we're going to do it, we need to do it in concert with the spring rehab project. We're gonna have some efficiency with a mobilized contractor. If we don't do it at the same time, you're probably not gonna be able to revisit this for 20, 50 years until you get another contractor out there for a small project like that. So I think if we're gonna do it, we really need to look at doing it now. So this is adding a feasibility study, but it is time sensitive. And the last one is, I don't see where we're ever gonna be able to come up with the maintenance dollars for the rehab of the bridge, so we need to, in order to use REIT dollars, we're recommending that we need this amendment in order to use REIT dollars to for the repairs that and rehabilitation that's needed on the bridge.
So, question? Because we got some 2019 expenditures for both the traffic impact fee and the water power generation. By doing the CIP, that's not going to fix the budget. There'll be a budget amendment coming in at the end of the year to cover that. Okay. The out years, I assume that then once this is in our CIP, then you can start budgeting for 2020-2021.
And for the water power generation project, the language in the council action bill is also for an appropriation. It's for to approve the contract and appropriate the funds. So there's two pieces of action related to that project. But that's coming in at the council meeting next week. Any questions? Any other questions related to the CIP addendum?
So, you can go home and enjoy the sunshine.
Thank you. <Woo-hoo. laughs>
And we'll have Ms. Kincaid present her information that she has on the sensitive area ordinance.
Okay, sensitive area ordinance and shoreline. And actually, Mayor, if it's okay, I'd like to start with shoreline.
Sure.
Okay. So, really, this is a chance for me to get into code discussion and for you to start to ask questions before these things come before you and you know, just, oh, sure, thank you. And before you get these big volumes of development code with strike through and underline that can be pretty mind-numbing.
Why don't you give me one for Chris, and then if he doesn't show up,
there we go.
We can put it in his box.
So just briefly, Title 19 in our municipal code is the regulates the environment. Within that title, you have these chapters. That's where you have the SEPA regulations adopted, the SMP, the Shoreline Management Program, the Sensitive Areas Ordinance, and the Transfer of Development Rights. Those are all in that Title 19. When and the state requires periodic updates, as you know, of comprehensive plans to be compliant with the Growth Management Act and Sensitive Area Ordinance and Shoreline Management Programs. So in our case, we were required to do our comp plan update in 2015. Our Sensitive Area Ordinance was due a year later in 2016. 2016, and then Ecology followed up with the periodic update for the shoreline management program. And they had grant money available, $10,000 for a city of our size to do that. So we were in the throes of just desperately trying to get our comp plan update done to be compliant with GMA. And as soon as we finished that, rather than rolling into the sensitive area ordinance, we needed to accept that grant before it went away for the shoreline program. So now we're ready to bring the shoreline program to hearing for that update. And so it's a really kind of a complicated, so with the shoreline management program, this is the one, I shouldn't say one, but this is probably the most top-down regulatory planning document that we have. Because unlike the comprehensive plan and our development regulations and our code, the shoreline management program is the state's. The state approves it. And so what that means is there's very little local discretion about what you adopt. And so the whole purpose of our needing to adopt this update is to be compliant with any of the rules that the state has changed, primarily. There are a few local, a few areas where we had some local discretion, and I'll kind of go through those. But by and large, there are not big changes that were required to our shoreline plan. Ecology has very specific a process to go through. We started with, you know, you have to have a website, and you have to have public participation. We held two open houses on these updates and posted the draft changes that we were proposing. And then you have to give a 30-day notice for a public hearing, and which we've done, and our public hearing is scheduled for the 20th of June. It'll be a joint hearing, which means that a person from the Department of Ecology will come in, and I passed this step three out just so you could kind of understand. They tried to, with the joint thing, they tried to make it less back and forth, but it's still kind of a lot of back and forth. So we will have our, this timeline here, we're gonna have our hearing, but then after we have our hearing, we close the hearing, and any comments, the staff will need to write a matrix of those comments received and a response to those comments. And then we actually have to send that to Ecology, so they still have to come back with a finding before you can adopt it, that it's consistent. Once we get this finding from Ecology that our update is consistent, then we actually, and they have 30 days to do that. Looks like they can get in at 45 days if they need to. But once, and so the first time we send it to them, they may not come back with this letter. We hope that they will. We've been working with them all along. But there could
be
some.
Let the record show that Chris Lisnowski is now present.
There could be some back and forth, but then once Ecology sends us this letter that says, okay, you're good. You're good to adopt this plan. That's when we have to come back to you again. So it could be like up to 45 days after we have this hearing in June with the ordinance to adopt. So there's still a lot of, a kind of, like I said, potential back and forth, but we've been working closely with Ecology to try to really minimize that. So hopefully when we have our hearing, our joint hearing, I'm gonna have our Ecology rep open the hearing and give you kind of a little, just, she'll do some slides about, you know, what Ecology is looking for, and then I'll give my staff report. You will have had the public hearing document with the strike through underline showing the changes, open the hearing, take the testimony, close the testimony, and then it rolls on from there. So shorelines, the shorelines of the state is how we think of them, because they are regulated and managed by the State Department of Ecology, is an extra layer of regulation over the critical areas. There's some overlap, one of the things that we dis- discovered, one of the biggest things in terms of what we needed to change were recognizing that because we're out of order, because our sensitive area ordinance didn't get done, we, the wetlands that are associated, we only have Lake Sawyer's, the only shoreline of the state here in Black Diamond. There's kind of criteria for what's a shoreline of the state, and the only water body here that met that is Lake Sawyer. But the associated wetlands around a water body, with near a shoreline, have to be regulated at a little higher level. And so our wetland rating system in the sensitive area is lagging. So we had this inconsistency between the plans from the very beginning because we did them out of order. So one of the things that we did to fix that is we took, we just sort of struck in the shoreline plan the existing reference to the sensitive area ordinance that ecology would have said, well, this is no good because your sensitive area ordinance is no good. So we did a workaround, which was okay with ecology, to take those references out. And then instead we listed very specific language that's going to just speak to the wetlands that are associated in the shorelands designation. So we have basically the sensitive areas ordinance, when we get that up, when we use that now, but when you're looking at sensitive areas that are in a shoreline, then you go to this other document. So you kind of have to look at two sections, and that is just the way it is. It's confusing for a lot of people, the lay people, but that's just something that we try to explain the best we can.
When you say lay people, you mean us.
No, I don't mean you specifically.
So can I just clarify,
please.
When
yeah.
you're talking about comparing the two documents
mm-hmm.
and kind of going back and forth
yep.
to fit them, are you saying that that's always the case, or is that just because we're still working on both pieces?
That's just because we didn't get our sensitive area ordinance
okay.
done in time.
So when it's all finished, then it will be a cohesive one document.
There will always be two documents.
Oh, okay.
But they'll be consistent. They have to be consistent. It would have been a whole lot easier if we had had our sensitive area ordinance done early on, like we were supposed to, because then we wouldn't be having to come up with a workaround in the shoreline plan to make it work.
But then the next time we get ready to update these documents, we'll do it in the correct order, and then you won't have that problem, right?
Right, exactly. You know, and really, it's not as big as it sounds. It's just comes down to we did this in 20. So the shoreline was done in 2014, and the sensitive area ordinance was done in 2009. Well, in 2014, really shortly after we did this, Department of Ecology came out with a new wetland rating system.
When?
2014. So the 2009 sensitive area ordinance does not reflect that, and therefore the sensitive area, I mean, we just had to kind of make it work, which ecology has looked at this draft, and they're pretty comfortable with it. I will say that the one thing that nobody has really said anything about it, but in this document there's a table of wetland buffers. So when you have, and please stop me if I, you know, I'm starting to talk technical stuff, and if it's like, what is that, how does that work, stop me. But so when you have a wetland, you have to have a buffer around it mm-hmm. to protect that wetland. And so that size of that buffer is dependent on what type of wetland you have. Mm-hmm. So that's the rating system. So the old rating system, resulted in the sensitive area buffers that we have now. When we go through an update, they could change. I don't think they'll change much. In the sensitive or in the shoreline plan, we actually adopted more conservative buffers. And so one thing that you will see at the hearing that is not in this document is a staff report recommending that we also include some language. What the term that they use is minimization. So yes, the buffer widths are very large according to Ecology's guidance, because we didn't have anything else to use, but we're also gonna use Ecology's guidance for when you could minimize or shrink those by doing certain things. So that will be something that you don't have in this language, but I'll be talking about that at the hearing. The other really big changes to the shoreline plan is the dollar amounts raised, because when you do shorelines, you have, there's a dollar amount set by the Office of Financial Management, the OFM. If it's, if the, whatever you're building is over a threshold, a dollar threshold, then it's considered a substantial development. And then it has to go through a shoreline permit. Shoreline permits for substantial development have to go to Ecology for approval. Things that fall below that threshold can be done under a shoreline exemption, and so they raise that dollar amount to for inflation. So we raised that because OFM raised it, we raised it in this plan. The other thing that we did that's different besides the wetland buffer table and the dollar amount and working around that wetland buffer problem is we added a chapter, it's gonna be all brand new, you'll see all the red, that's called, or excuse me, a section for exemptions, exceptions, because you have these categories where does it need a shoreline permit, or is it exempt from a shoreline permit? But the thing that we were missing that was really confusing people is when is it a total exception? And so when someone comes in, and we adopted Ecology's language primarily, but the biggest one that we came in confusion is people that are saying like, well, I want to do some landscaping. Can I do some landscaping? Can I remove trees or shrubs? We now have language in here that says, you don't need to go through the city to get either a permit or an exemption for doing landscaping in the shoreline. So, and then the other one that is minor maintenance or repair of lawfully established. So there's this real gray area. I'm like, well, now if I just need to replace a rotten board on my decking, do I really need to go to the city and get this exemption from the shoreline? This helps people understand here's when you don't have to. So we felt that that would be very helpful. And then the other thing that we did, that we had the local this is how Ecology said, well, you can do this if you want to. This is the kind of the carrot they gave us, is non-conforming. So as you know, when we adopted the shoreline, according to the requirements from Ecology, a lot of development became non-conforming with this. And so we had called it out as this is non-conforming to the regulations. Well, Ecology said if you want to include some language that says we're not calling you non-conforming, you can. It's kind of like wordsmithing, that this is a lawfully established use or structure prior to the date of the adoption.
So you're kind of grandfathered in.
Language. But non-conforming, you're still grandfathered in. It was just that lenders had a really hard time when someone comes in and says, I want to buy this house, and it's non-conforming. So this is again to try to help our citizenry to not run into, silly language blocks, really.
Something pre-existing.
Exactly. So those are really the main changes that we're going to bring forward on that shoreline management program. Any questions on that?
So on the part where you said you don't have to come to the city if you're removing a tree or anything, but you still have to come to the city
for the tree permit. But you don't need to get a short. Pardon me, that was
okay,
bad.
Yeah, so
not for a shoreline permit.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Do we have
yeah.
language in there that says that kind of says you still have to follow?
We do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, you do.
That'll help clarify. People won't be like, but it says here.
Shrubs. If you cut down a tree, yeah. If you're trimming your shrub, no.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But it does have language about you still have to. But there's a lot of words here. really a lot for people to try to, you know, it's like.
Absorb.
Yeah, and so we need to try to do a little more, maybe out.
How many, do we know how many property owners this affects? How many property owners?
Around the lake?
340.
There's 340 parcels around the lake?
Oh.
And the reason I know that is back in 1999, Kevin Esping and I did a lot of the walking, we did it by boat, we did the dock numbers.
Oh.
And so that's how I know there's 340 properties.
There you go. Well, you know, we did hold two, public meetings as required. The first one we had at the Lakeshore Community Club. It wasn't particularly well attended, but we did have, I don't know, 20, 25 people. The second one we held here and, didn't get anybody.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry, we had.
Our husbands showed up, we were here, there were like six of us.
Okay.
Maybe.
There were people here.
We are lake residents, so, yeah.
Of course you are.
We get a. Of course I am.
So, but it was a pretty small group.
It was tiny, yeah.
Very small.
And then we had, we've already taken this, through the planning commission, they had to have their hearing, and nobody came to the planning commission hearing, no, nobody. So, this draft has been out there, and I really think that the people that came to that first meeting that it were involved in putting together this, and that really are really paying attention, had, I'm going to assume they really don't have any issues, or we would have.
Is the draft up on the website or something where people could see it?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing too is that, because I was here when we did the 2014 update, that was huge.
Yeah.
We had multiple work sessions, we actually allowed two of the residents to sit at the table and give us some input, because they both had, well, you know, Bill Combo's got a lot of property on the lake.
Right.
Jack Sperry's got a unique property that he wanted to make sure that it was protected.
Right.
And so we allowed them to actively participate in what we were doing.
What are you doing?
Sign language.
Oh.
Well, he was asking for water, but he kinda used the wrong sign.
Anyway, but what I wanted to, what the main point is that the people that really cared put it in on the 2014 version. This is an update, it's not as big a deal.
It really isn't, it's pretty minor, and I would say too that this, this thing with the wetland buffers around the lake, we really haven't identified wetland around Lakeshore. You've got the lake, and of course you've got your shoreline setback, which is 50 feet from the ordinary high water mark. I haven't had anybody come in with a development permit where it popped up they had wetland in that area also. So I think.
Because it's already developed, you've got the ponds there on 232nd, those went in, what, 20 years ago? There is a pond there.
Yep.
But when they got their permits, when they applied, it was, the nearest body of water was Lake Sawyer.
Yeah.
And then there's Frog Lake that will never be developed because it's parkland.
Right.
So I don't see, at least in the greater Lake Sawyer area, that there would be anything.
Yeah, there's pretty, yeah, it's.
And it's mostly built up now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But you know, we're seeing a lot of redevelopment around the lake.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, when we've had several pretty large homes under review and done the sensitive area review, and other than the shoreline, there haven't. So I just don't think it's gonna be affect. I mean, sure, there could be somebody that we find there's wetland, but I don't think it's gonna affect people, we need to do this, we need to make sure that there's something in place that should we find that there's an associated wetland and that we have an appropriate buffer to protect that and the shore and the water, and so we, of course, we have that and we're gonna regulate that.
Does the state have a recommendation on how often we should update the sensitive areas plan?
Every 8 years.
Every
8 years.
We're a little bit out.
We're a little bit out. So with the sensitive area plan, if you don't have any more questions on shoreline, SMP, you know that we thought we were in pretty good shape with GMA compliance by getting our comp plan adopted. And then when Public Works, they've been working on some grants, and then the question came up, but your sensitive area ordinance, they call it critical area ordinance everywhere else, but we call ours a sensitive area ordinance. You didn't get that done, and so we're on a fast track by the end of the year. So, we went out and, you always start with the checklist. They always, these updates, they always give you a checklist, which is very helpful to go through, and you're primarily looking for, what's changed since you last adopted it, you know, what rules, regulations have changed, what's changed in your local conditions, and what do you know now that you didn't know then when you did it? And so when we've been through the checklist, and there aren't, we're in pretty good shape, even though this was done in 2009. The best available science that we had, we went through a big effort and a very a good effort with Parametrics doing the best available science. And that's one of the biggest things that ecology says, that, you know, you gotta have your best available science done. And so we are looking at needing to go probably out for a consultant to help us do the work, but it won't be such a big expensive effort. We don't anticipate needing to go out and getting biologists or scientists to redo any science. So it'll be more like a, kind of like it was with the shoreline plan update, you know, just a few things that we noticed when we did the checklist is the wetland rating that I talked about already. FEMA and there's been a long history where FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers and the federal government have been concerned about fish. Very, you know, and so they went through a big fish thing. Well,
why would FEMA care about fish?
Well, there's a
the fish have an emergency that needs to be managed?
Well, it's related to the biological assessment that development could impact fish, and you know, FEMA has flood hazard regulations. They have a role in development. And so then they have this relationship with the Army Corps of Engineers. So really they came through a big court, kind of a court case, and they came back and they said that local governments need to make sure that they are addressing this sort of, they have a three-prong thing, like you, local government, you can do this, this, or this. And the third prong, which we just are missing in our, would be to put the burden on the developer to do the science if they want to develop somewhere where we're, just like we do with the wetlands. Mm-hmm. If you want to develop property and we think you have wetland, if you want to develop property and you've got a stream that has salmon, then we will require you to go get the scientific, do the scientific work rather than the city doing the paying.
Is it
for
just
that.
Salmon, or do they have other species that they?
It's salmon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm not up enough of, I can't remember enough how that all went through to be able to give you a good explanation. It was, but that's something that we'll have to address. The other thing is that, of course, our wetlands definition, we have to make sure the SMP and the sensitive area ordinance are consistent, so we'll be tweaking the wetlands definition to be consistent with what we adopt in the SMP. The delineation, we didn't see that there needed to be any change in the delineation and the mapping, because what we have, and when we require a developer to do the delineation. The wetland rating system we need to adopt, and so what that'll do is it'll make that table look a little different. I don't know exactly what it will do to the buffer widths that we currently have. The old system had a classification that was class 1, 2, 3, and 4 wetland. The new rating system, you know, these are forms that you go out in the field. They're based on scores, habitat scores. So there's a kind of a conversion there, and I don't know what that'll look like when we get done. We quit a critical aquifer recharge areas. That's something that to work on a little bit. We just, we don't mention the quantity. We've got the Springs and the Tacoma Inner Tie. Again, this is sort of more text, more cleaning up the text and stuff that is, we're missing. And we need to beef up our flood regulations. Frequently flooded areas are another section in our sensitive area ordinance. And we don't really say much because we don't have many flood areas. We have a little bit, but we do need to, just, make sure that that mentions that, you know, if you're building in a 100-year floodplain, which you won't because our 100-year floodplain is already in an associated, I mean, you know, it just isn't gonna happen here, but we need to include that language, just to be, I'm sure, so that, we're in good shape here. Well, let's see. We need to update and strengthen our definition and maybe regulations on fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas. One of the things that we basically just, we don't mention wildlife. We could do more, and I, you know, with maybe the species of local importance, and talk about whether we want to, like the elk kind of fall through the crack. You know, we have some critters that aren't on the
radar.
The radar, and so we may want to talk about putting those local species on our radar,
like our new pet deer and new pet bear.
We have lots of bears.
Oh my.
The bears are out.
There are several bears.
Yeah. Waters of the state. The other thing is with again with the fish, and this is a kind of a question that I kicked around is. The culvert cases, you know, the culvert against the fish, and I'm going to look into ecology's guidance, maybe have a conversation with the biologist there about should we be putting some language in our, about a culvert's and fish passage as they relate to culverts, because that's gonna come up, and we don't really want to be backpedaling when we need to replace a culvert, because we might need to, and so we'll want to look at that a little closer.
Well, we have our first test with the Covington Creek culverts.
And right. What happens if the culvert's on private property?
Well, private property is regulated by sensitive area ordinance.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because there is a culvert at Ravensdale Creek before it goes into the lake.
Oh, okay.
And so...
And it's fish passing,
No, no, it belongs to the city.
Does that belong
to
the city?
That's all our right of way.
Oh, I thought I was thinking. Yeah.
I thought
that's
that
all
was,
our right of way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Forest practices. We don't really mention forest practices, but we probably want to make sure that we're tying that back to. We do have large tracts of land that do get cleared, and so we probably want to look at the language that we have and see if we can do something a little more there. And then they had good ideas, and I'll be darned, we're doing almost all of these good ideas already.
Good.
So that was pretty good. We were able to check it off. They had public education. Yes, I believe that we're doing public education. Stewardship programs is the one we don't do. Pursuing grant opportunities, water conservation, joint planning, stream and wetland restoration, and transfer of development rights. So there's a lot of these good ideas that we've already been implementing.
Wait, they said TDRs was a good idea?
Mm-hmm.
Did they understand it?
Nope. They work in ecology. They come up with these wonderful ideas, and they never have to make them up.
Yes.
It's true, though.
Yeah.
But that's really, I just wanted to kind of get this on your radar, because we're going to be fast-tracking this. And I wanted to make sure, mainly because there's so much technical stuff here, that if you can, you know, you want to ask questions about that now, we can maybe get the primer, you know, the basics of what this all does and what it means. But
okay, so we need to have a consultant to work on this.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have that in the budget, or are we going to need an amendment, or how is that going to work?
We talked about that.
We're going to need an amendment. We're going to need an amendment, because we're going to have to use
We were going to see if we could use REAP, but David said
we can't use REAP dollars, but we will have to have a budget amendment, but we will be able to do the work.
And the other thing too, is it's just like one big budget amendment at the end of the year, and everything gets put in there.
Right, right. I was just wondering if this is already in the budget.
But we, well, because we didn't, it is not in the budget. We really thought we would put it in the budget and be able to do it next year, but then.
We need to push it forward.
We need to push it forward to be able to get the grants, for the projects we have going.
Right, got it.
And that's important.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
So does anybody have any more questions? Would entertain a motion to adjourn?
Make a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.